Okay, now, again, four main groupings to think of in terms of World Anti-Communist League. North America, South America, Europe and Eurasia, and Asia. We're going to be looking at North America, the conclusion of North America. We're going to be taking a look at Asia and Europe this evening, Latin America next week. And again, the sort of underlying premise of the World Anti-Communist League is that we're going to be looking at WACL as a reformation and continuation of the very same elements which we looked at combining in the Axis powers of World War II. Sort of a new axis, I guess one could think of the World Anti-Communist League as being, or perhaps making a slight joke on our Aryan Nations title, we could think of this as the Aryan International, in a manner of speaking, because that's exactly what it is. But keep in mind our two major themes, four breakdowns, four major elements in it, three of which we're going to look at this evening, one of which mostly by way of conclusion, and looking at the World Anti-Communist League as the new anti-Comintern, as an extension of or reformation of the Axis powers of World War II. Now, by way of looking at some of the stages involved in the actual hard formation of the World Anti-Communist League, we're going to take a look at a 1958 Mexico City conference, which was sort of a pre-WACL-WACL. It was a pre-World Anti-Communist League steering conference, and it was specifically the WACCFL, as it was called, was aimed at the eventual formation of the World Anti-Communist League. Again, WACL formed by way of the coalition, or the coalescing, of a number of different groups over a period of time, and it was very self-conscious. In other words, these groups were working to combine, and the steering committees that we're going to be looking at here were designed with very much that thing and that kind of thing in mind. The following article appeared in a publication called The Public Eye. That's put out basically by the National Lawyers Guild, or a subgroup of it. This is from Public Eyes, Volume 2, numbers issues number 1 and 2. That's from 1979. I'm not sure which month in that year. This article from Public Eye is called The World Anti-Communist League, edited by Charles Goldman. And skipping down in the article, we're going to take a look at the actual hard formation of WACL coming out of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League. That is the Asian branch of WACL, one of the things that we're going to be looking at this evening, and one of the dominant elements in the coalescing of these various groups into one group, the World Anti-Communist League. Reading now from Public Eye, Volume 2, issues number 1 and 2, this from 1979. The Asian People's Anti-Communist League, APACL, is the organizational backbone of WACL and remains to this day a powerful force in most non-communist Asian countries. Founded in 1954 to mobilize a political front against the two communist giants, the People's Republic of China in particular, it emerged from and remained in the hands of Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang Party, the KMT. The KMT furnished the APACL its president, Ku Cheng Kang, and vice president, Fang Qi, leaders as well of the Free China Relief Agency from which several APACL activities originated. In the late 1950s, APACL was implicated in the first of a series of onerous affairs. San Francisco police identified Chung Wing Fong, a leader of the Chinese Anti-Communist League, the Chinese American subsidiary of the APACL, as the key to a narcotics deal after nabbing couriers with nearly 300 pounds of pure heroin. Strings were soon pulled, and Chung, a high-standing Korean intelligence agent with CIA connections, slipped off to Taiwan. A primary source of funds to Taiwan and all APACL members was the smuggling of opium from the Golden Triangle junction of Burma, Laos, and Thailand. Available evidence indicates that Ku Cheng Kang and Fang Qi themselves organized the Triangle's opium-smuggling KMT forces, conducting negotiations with opium-cultivating Mao tribesmen and Laotian generals, and, with CIA assistance, arranging the opium airlift via civil air transport of 50-50 Taiwan CIA proprietary. The enormous funds were invested in influence, above all in the U.S., where a secret APACL contact group forming the heart of the China lobby was chaired by New Jersey Governor and Navy Secretary Charles Edison of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, WACCFL, Steering Committee. Now this World Anti-Communist, interrupting briefly, this World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation is one of the pre-WACL steering committees which was aiming specifically and overtly at the formation of the World Anti-Communist League. Their goal was realized in 1966. Continuing. Oh, well, by the way, before continuing, the World Anti-Communist League role in members of the World Anti-Communist League's role in narcotics trafficking is something we're going to be coming back to when we get into the subject of the intelligence community and narcotics. And we'll be talking about that at great length in the future. And in general, it should be noted that World Anti-Communist League will be cropping up in broadcasts, in other archive broadcasts. So we're just going to sort of lay the groundwork in these. They will be coming back to WACL many times in the future. Continuing. In March of 1958, as the Cold War appeared to cool off, representatives of the most fanatically anti-Red groupings met in Mexico City to plan a semi-clandestine WACCFL to stoke the fires of confrontation. A dozen countries and a string of organizations were represented, including APACL members. Elected to its steering committee were Dr. Kucheng Kang of Taiwan, Dr. L. George Paik of South Korea, Dr. Nien Hung Tuong of South Vietnam, Admiral Kerr, well, then the printing becomes kind of obscured here, so I'm not going to read you the whole list. Suffice it to say that the committee involves the main names to, and remember here, Charles Edison, the China lobby member cited above here, Lev Dobryansky of the ABN, a fellow we're going to be looking at great length, Marvin Liebman, key China lobby member discussed below, a man named Fritz Kramer with a C, that's C-R-A-M-E-R, not the man we're looking at in connection with the Pentagon on the May Russell broadcasts, but Fritz Kramer, C-R-A-M-E-R, from West Germany. And also Yaroslav Stetsko of the Ukrainian Independent Republic. We'll look at him later in the broadcast. Continuing here, Marvin Liebman was elected General Secretary and Francis J. McNamara Vice General Secretary. Alfred Geilen, G-I-E-L-E-N of West Germany, Ernesto de la Fe of Cuba, and Inamullah Khan of Pakistan were elected Regional Secretaries for, respectively, Europe, Latin America, and Asia. Let's take a closer look at these men and the enormous concentrations of political and economic power they represented, remembering that the majority remain in the WACL hardcore. One of the big four groupings in the WACCFL steering committee came from the American far right. As mentioned earlier, former Navy Secretary Charles Edison headed the APACL's secret U.S. connection and was part of the China lobby's hardcore. He was also a member of the John Birch Society and the American Security Council, the latter one of the most powerful WACL links to the U.S. A coalition of former intelligence agents, industrialists, and politicians of the far right, the American Security Council was formed in 1955 on the initiative of former G-men. It was to play sister to the West German Volksbund für Frieden und Freiheit, in whose mold it conducted security checks on applicants for employment in private firms. Its more than 1 million files on allegedly dangerous persons was derived from the anti-Semitic archives assembled by Harry A. Jung's American Vigilante Intelligence Federation, which worked closely in the 1930s with the Goebbels anti-Comintern. I'll also tell you that you're listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills. And basically, where we're going to be beginning our hard discussion of the membership, the big four groupings in WACL, concerns the American Security Council, the key link-up of WACL in the United States.
Okay, now, you've heard a couple of names. We're going to begin to explore a little bit more how some of these people got connected into this in the first place and went on to help to shape the World Anti-Communist League as it stands today, again, as a major instrument of American foreign policy and a major influence on American foreign and internal policy. The next segment we're going to read to you is from a book called Power on the Right by William W. Turner, copyright 1971 by Ramparts Press. William Turner, of course, somebody whose work we use quite a bit, a former FBI man himself, a man who has been involved in politics and political journalism and all kinds of things. Anyway, he's going to be talking about the American Security Council to begin with. He says, despite the official ring to its name, the American Security Council is not the other league to the National Security Council, nor does it have any formal government status. It is a pressure and propaganda group funded by blue-chip corporations, which promotes a tough military stance based on hardline anti-communism. In its field, the ASC may be just as influential in shaping U.S. policy as the National Security Council. After the seesaw legislative battle of 1969 over the Safeguard ABM system, President Nixon acknowledged in writing that, quote, the American Security Council played a major role in achieving that victory, unquote. Since the margin of victory for the pro-ABM forces was one vote, it is conceivable that the ASC played a decisive role. In any event, the ASC is one of the most powerful mainsprings of the right. I first became aware of the ASC in 1962, Turner writes, when I noticed some of its literature on the desk of another former FBI agent who was a security officer at the University of California's Lawrence Radiation Laboratory. In exploring further, it turned out that the ASC is a kind of FBI offshoot. It was founded in 1955 by former G-men. G-men, of course, is an old-fashioned term now for FBI agents and Treasury folks, otherwise known as government men or G-men. And the initial service it offered member firms was a dossier system modeled after the FBI's, which was intended to weed out employees and prospective employees deemed disloyal to the free enterprise concept. The Joseph McCarthy virulence and the Cold War were both at their peak when the ASC began as the Mid-American Research Library. The impetus was provided by the late General Robert E. Wood, then board chairman of Sears Roebuck and Company, along with the cantankerous Colonel Robert R. McCormick of the Chicago Tribune, the world's greatest newspaper, the Colonel used to trumpet, and its radio station call letters are still WGN. Wood, this is Robert E. Wood, chairman of Sears, Wood had been a prime mover in the isolationist America First Committee and a prime adversary of the trade union movement. With the growing preoccupation of industry with, quote, security, the establishment of a private body that would provide corporations with a blacklist service and loyalty review board was almost inevitable. Expanding rapidly, the Mid-American Research Library was renamed the American Security Council in 1956, when former FBI agent John M. Fisher, who had come to Sears as a, quote, personnel consultant with J. Edgar Hoover's blessing in 1953, was installed as president and executive director. Before long, Fisher had surrounded himself with bureau-trained men. Jack E. Eisen, ISON, was appointed operating director, and William K. Lambie, Jr., research director. Both had put in a few years with the FBI. Both are still in those positions. W. Cleon Skousen, S-K-O-U-S-E-N, who was named field director, had been an agent from 1940 to 1951, and is well known in right-wing circles as the author of The Naked Communist and The Communist Attack on U.S. Police. Skousen left the American Security Council in 1960 to become a John Birch functionary and is a perennial figure on the Society's lecture circuit. In time, retired FBI Assistant Director Stanley J. Tracy was brought in to sit on the strategy staff. Among the non-staff officers with a history under J. Edgar Hoover are Senior Vice President Kenneth M. Piper, quote, Director of Human Relations for Motorola, Vice President Stephen L. Donchus, a U.S. Steel executive, and Vice President Russell E. White, a General Electric security consultant. For the first few years, the ASC devoted itself to amassing the dossier system housed in the, quote, Research and Information Center in the executive offices at 123 North Wacker Drive in Chicago. In 1958, it purchased a collection of 1 million names from the estate of Harry Jung, spelled like the psychologist, J-U-N-G, publisher of American Vigilante, and described by the Chicago Sun-Times at the time as, quote, one of Chicago's most notorious purveyors of anti-Semitic propaganda during the late 1930s, and an old-time labor foe. The system is constantly being enlarged through contributions from the security departments of member firms, from the transcripts of hearings staged by state and federal, quote, anti-subversive committees, and from the cullings of a full-time staff reviewing thousands of publications for data on, quote, left-wingers.
Okay, now two of the names to remember in that discussion are those of General Robert Wood and Colonel Robert McCormick. Now, both of those people were very closely affiliated with American fascism in the 1930s and subsequently, and both people cropped up in connection with Radio Free America number 11, our Aryan Nations, in fact, both 11 and 12, our Aryan Nations series. Now, General Robert Wood and McCormick were both very closely affiliated with a group called America First, which basically, although it maintained that it was isolationist in nature, was an explicitly fascist group with hard links to the German Ausland organization, its overseas intelligence and agitation organization. And again, we looked at America First in our Aryan Nations shows number 11 and 12, primarily show number 11. So two of the same people that are involved with American Security Council, also very much involved with American promoting fascism in this country in the 30s and 40s. Now, remember Harry Jung and his American Intelligence Vigilante group here, because that group also was a fascist group during the 1930s and 40s, and it had hard links with Third Reich overseas activities. Reading now from a book called Undercover, that was authored by John Roy Carlson, the pen name for a former FBI informant named Arthur Derunian. The book was published in hardcover by E.P. Dutton & Company, copyright 1943. And of Mr. Jung's, of Harry Jung's organization and its connections with various people, specifically here, Colonel Robert McCormick, the fellow who later was connected with the American Security Council, who absorbed Jung's files, Carlson writes as follows in Undercover. Mrs. A.D. Risdon, R-I-S-D-O-N, was third in command of the Mothers. The Mothers, by the way, is a group of mothers' organizations assembled by the Father Coughlin organization, known collectively as the Coughlinite Mothers. There are groups like the Mothers of the United States, the American Mothers, and so forth. So that's the, those are the mothers referred to here. Mrs. A.D. Risdon was third in command of the Mothers during Mrs. Dilling's frequent absences. A large and impressive woman, member of the America First Committee and Citizens Keep America Out of War Committee of Chicago, she urged me to write to the chairman of the latter group, Captain William J. Grace. When I told her of Joe McWilliams and his relations with Newton Jenkins fronting for the Bund in Chicago, Mrs. Risdon said, "You'd better tell him to keep away from Jenkins. He is an opportunist and will turn anything that promises, it will turn to anything that promises money. Mr. McWilliams had better get in touch with Harry Jung. He is 1,000,000% okay." I could not easily forget her phrase, 1,000,000% okay. Mrs. Risdon added that Jung was in the Chicago Tribune building and that Colonel Robert R. McCormick, publisher of the Tribune, not only aided Jung financially, but allegedly provided free office space for Jung. Noting here again that both Jung and Robert, both Jung's files and the research of his organization and Colonel Robert R. McCormick, the man who helped sponsor him, were to combine with the American Security Council years later.
Okay, well, we're also looking at the kinds of membership and the kinds of ideology that fueled the American Security Council. We're going to look at a few particular names.
One more item before we get into the American Security Council per se. Continuing again with the, with Harry Jung here. The Jung, it should be noted here, one thing that I forgot to, perhaps the most important article here, the element, I should say, that should be included, concerns the fact that Harry Jung's organization worked very closely not only with the World Service, that was the Overseas Propaganda and Agitation Service of the Third Reich, but also, among others, they worked with William Dudley Pelley of the Silver Shirts. A member of the Silver Shirts eventually founded the Posse Comitatus, a key member of the Aryan Nations, and we've looked at William Dudley Pelley's associations with the MacArthur Group and the Third Reich in our Aryan Nations series. Now, it's worth noting that Harry Jung's group was very much connected with the Third Reich and specifically with the World Service, the Overseas Goebbels Propaganda Organization, which was very much, very active in the Anti-Comintern group, which we're going to look at later. Continuing with Undercover by John Roy Carlson. In 1933, Jung made membership in his American Vigilant Intelligence Federation secret with secret codes and mysterious rituals. And in 1935, its organ, the Vigilante, had so well served the fascist cause that World Service placed it on its honor roll. Jung also went into the wholesale distribution of the protocols and wrote Harry F. Sieber, then treasurer of the Silver Shirts, quote, "We can give you a price of 60 cents per copy in quantity lots of the protocols. As for halt Gentile and salute the Jew, same can be had at 10 cents per copy in quantity lots of, for 15 cents apiece." Jung's associates in those days included Peter Afanasieff, a White Guard Russian born in Petrograd in 1893, who arrived in San Francisco in 1922. With three other White Russians, Afanasieff worked on a new translation of the protocols in Jung's office and soon after became affiliated with the New York and Chicago branches of the Bund. When he assumed the alias Prince Peter Kushubu, K-U-S-H-U-B-U, B-U-E, the doors of society opened to him and the bogus prince almost succeeded in getting a wealthy heiress to marry him. But when the scheme fell through, the frustrated prince changed his name to Armstrong and tried his hand at forgery. He was convicted of forging a United States Treasury check, and federal judge F.J. Kerrigan sentenced him to 18 months in the penitentiary. Together with Captain Victor Decayville, born Levok, a former officer in the Tsarist army who jumped ship, Afanasieff helped publish The American Gentile. It was, quote, "a patriotic, American, pro-Aryan semi-monthly published for the defense of Gentile culture and civilization," unquote. James True and Robert Edward Edmondson wrote for it, and articles from World Service found their way in. The American Gentile became the filthiest Nazi front sheet of its period in Chicago and deserved the praise which it received in World Service. So basically, the not only was Harry Jung a part of the American fascist movement, but he worked specifically in terms of his propaganda efforts in conjunction with Joseph Goebbels and the Third Reich and the Nazi World Service. And it's worth noting here also that Harry Jung worked with White Russians who even at this date were conspiring with fascists from the international community to basically use the Third Reich and fascism as their ticket back into Russia. But note that Harry Jung and his organization, the American Vigilant Intelligence Federation, worked with the Goebbels World Service, and their files incorporated into the American Security Council, and that Jung also worked with Colonel McCormick, who also was very much affiliated with American Security Council in its early years.
Okay, some more things on the American Security Council. This is more reading from William Turner's Power on the Right. And looking at a couple of different things here, some plans for the use of Chinese nationalist troops. You'll remember Chinese nationalists in the APACL, the first and most important parts of the World Anti-Communist League. And then a little later on, as I was talking about at the beginning of the broadcast, about the image of basically a bunch of pretty sad sack sort of Eastern European emigre groups being the folks who are responsible for things like the World Anti-Communist League. We're going to see a list of some names that not only are some of them quite significant, but gives you an idea of the kind of clout that these organizations can put together. Anyway, reading a bit from Power on the Right. They're talking about when they refer to the report, it's the American Security Council's newsletter, Washington Report. With Oakland Tribune publisher William F. Noland, the former, quote, senator from Formosa on the National Strategy Committee, it is not surprising that the report has consistently sought the unleashing of Chiang Kai-shek's forces on the mainland. But even Nolan's wildest urgings never encompassed what former ambassador to Brazil and Peru William D. Pauley proposed in the December 1960 report. Quote, we can support the beautifully equipped and trained, eager Chinese nationalist troops in Vietnam for a quarter of what American soldiers cost in that Asian theater, he wrote. There is no legal, ethical, or moral barrier to our assisting the Chinese nationalists to regain their homeland and to overthrow on the way home the bloody communist tyranny which holds much of Vietnam in its grip. So there's William Pauley, a man whose name crops up quite often in these things, advocating the use of Chinese troops in Vietnam.
William Pauley, a key member of the China lobby, also very much involved with our Bay of Pigs activities and the Cuban Freikorps that we spoke about in Radio Free America number 12. In fact, Pauley's mentioned several times in that broadcast.
Absolutely. Reading a little further on in Power on the Right, the National Strategy Committee that steers American Security Council policy is a Clausewitzian crowd indeed. Of course, that reference to the famous war theorist. The chairman is Robert W. Galvin, chief executive officer of Motorola, a company that held, at last count, $9,495,000 worth of ABM subcontracts, those are the anti-ballistic missiles. General Electric leads ASC member companies with $45,289,735 worth. By the way, you remember earlier the comment that Richard Nixon made saying the American Security Council had helped to push the ABM through. You can see perhaps one of the reasons, besides their sheer patriotism, why they might have worked so hard for it. Co-chairman is Los Angeles lawyer Lloyd Wright, who has advocated preventive war and stated that the Republican Party should have, quote, 10,000 or 10 million more members like those I know in the John Birch Society. Prominent among the 21 aging military men on the board are General Albert C. Wiedemeyer. Wiedemeyer, of course, somebody that we've talked about a great deal and we will be talking about more. Admiral Louis L. Strauss, former Atomic Energy Commission chairman. General Curtis LeMay. General Nathan F. Twining, ex-chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Paul B. Adams, once head of the U.S. Strike Command. Admiral Ben Morrill, a Birch Society ally. General Bernard A. Shriver, former chief of the Air Force Systems Command. And General Thomas S. Power, former commander of the Strategic Air Command. In other words, you will notice an awful lot of brass at the top of the American Security Council and an awful lot of FBI men in the founding of the American Security Council. So you have two major branches, mostly the Air Force and the FBI, but right there, just as an example, two of the major branches of the U.S. intelligence and military apparatus directly involved with the American Security Council, which, as we are seeing and will continue to see, moves directly into today's World Anti-Communist League.
Note the presence of Albert Wiedemeyer on the board of directors, a key member of American Security Council, and the Queen Bee, or the King Bee, I guess you could say, of the China lobby. We're going to talk about Wiedemeyer in just a second. Note also the influence of the China lobby on American Security Council, and again, the links of the Jung organization, Harry Jung going back to the Third Reich, and common elements with the American Security Council. Not only do they absorb his files, but both Messrs. McCormick and Wood, very active on behalf of American fascism. McCormick specifically works with Jung, and then the two eventually are to be recombined, at least Jung by via his files in the American Security Council.
Recombinant ASC.
Okay,
we're gonna be. It's getting to be that time of the broadcast, so we're gonna take a break, and I'm sure you're ready for it too. So we're gonna take about 4 or 5 minutes, play a musical cut, give you a chance to march around a little bit and work off some of the tension of sitting in one place listening to this impressive roll of well-known fascists and lunatics, and then we're gonna be coming back with a long tape segment which we will introduce after the break and explain in a rather extended tape segment here. I don't know why I said brief, here to explain some various and sundry things. Now, some of these, most of the tape recordings we're going to be using tonight on the show, I believe all of them, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, there's going to be a long segment here from Radio Free America number 11, our program, our second Aryan Nation show, and specifically we were talking about the John Birch Society, and in talking about the John Birch Society, we thought we'd let people know who John Birch was. Now, what we're going to be doing now, having completed our discussion of the American Security Council, noting its links to American fascism in the 30s and 40s, noting the links of some of the elements in the recombinant ASC, as Nip noted, that go clear back to the Third Reich, noting its links also with the China lobby, and in particular the role of Albert Wiedemeyer in the American Security Council, because now we're going to take a look at the second of the major four groupings in WACL, the Asian Link. Now, specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the two primary Asian links, the Kuomintang of Chiang Kai-shek and now Chiang Ching-kuo, his son, and also elements of the South Korean National Security Establishment, principally the Unification Church. Now, rather than go into the history of South Korea per se, or the history of nationalist China as an independent entity per se, what we thought we'd do is we're going to show you how Chiang Kai-shek intersects not only with those American elements who we find in organizations like Aryan Nations, American Security Council, and so forth, but specifically how Chiang Kai-shek melded into the international fascist community of the 30s and 40s, because it's quite possible for people to go any place and read about nationalist China per se, about the struggle between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek, and how Chiang ascended to the Kuomintang presidency after Sun Yat-sen and so forth. That's not really our concern here. Our concern is how the Kuomintang came to be the one of the primary Asian elements of the fascist World Anti-Communist League. And so it's Chiang Kai-shek's relationships with international fascism and his relationships with those Americans who we find in these elements that we're going to be focusing on. And that's why we're going to be replaying a long section of Radio Free America number 11 talking about Albert Wiedemeyer, his political development, and his activities in conjunction with Chiang Kai-shek, and also some of the people that Chiang Kai-shek found himself able to make accommodations with.
All right, and so without further ado, a tape segment originally aired on Radio Free America number 11.
It's basically going to be one of the major focuses of our program.
And indeed, what we're going to focus on for a moment here is another significant and important military officer allied with MacArthur, somebody who had been urging MacArthur to run for president, as we will find out, himself with a rather curious idea of what constituted military loyalty to the Constitution, as opposed to the executive branch of government. Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who eventually became the commander-in-chief of the China Theater, replacing General Joseph Stilwell. Now, back in May of 1941, or April of 1941, rather, sometime after the Lend-Lease Act had been passed, the Lend-Lease Act, of course, was the United States' agreement basically to support Britain economically against the Nazis. While Roosevelt was trying to muster sentiment among the public and in the Congress to eventually, as Roosevelt knew would have to happen, have the United States go to war with Germany. Anyway, Chief of Staff General George C. Marshall asked the War Plans Division, of which Wiedemeyer was the head, I believe, at that time, to work up a plan for war in Europe to be fought, as any army, especially one the size of a major power like the United States, has to do, to work up a plan for war in Europe for the upcoming conflict. Now, reading again from Charles Higham's American Swastika. On September 11, 1941, the Army summarized its estimate along with naval requirements in a secret joint report, buttressed with appendixes, maps, charts, tables, and secret data on strategic assumptions and purposes, potential military objectives and targets, and estimates of military strength. Known as Rainbow Five, this remarkable document, running to some 17 pages originally but greatly expanded thereafter, called for an outright defeat of Nazi Germany in 1943, for which an appropriation of $150 billion would be required.
U.S. Army ground forces would be required to a total of 216 divisions, 61 of them armored, 51 separate motorized divisions, and a half a million men for anti-aircraft artillery units. It may be necessary to repeat that this was quite the most important single document in the possession of the Chiefs of Staff and of the White House. The architect of Rainbow 5 was Brigadier General Leonard T. Gerow, G-E-R-O-W, Chief of the War Plans Division. Secretary of War Stimson had handed the responsibility to General Marshall, who in turn passed it to Gerow. Gerow selected as his instrument of execution of the victory program Colonel Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who in the 1980s, was to be resurrected from the military mortuary to serve as special military advisor to President Ronald Reagan. Okay, so this is the same Albert C. Wiedemeyer we're talking about, who recently has been, as Haim puts it, resurrected from the military mortuary to serve as special military advisor to Reagan. Colonel Wiedemeyer had an interesting history. His father's parents were born in Germany, and he himself had been educated in part at the German War College in Berlin, otherwise known as the Kriegsakademie.
He graduated in 1938 during the year the Nazis were moving into Austria.
That's right, and I believe that all the other things, the Nazi racial laws and things like that, had been on the books for quite some time. Okay, so Wiedemeyer rented his apartment in the German capital from a member of the Nazi party, Gerhard Rosbach, R-O-S-S-B-A-C-H. We'll get back to him. And during his sojourn became a great friend of General Ludwig Beck, chief of the German General Staff. His introductions to Beck were arranged by Lieutenant General Friedrich von Boetticher, B-O-E-T-T-I-C-H-E-R, German military attaché in Washington. He corresponded regularly with his German contacts until the advent of World War II in Europe. He was friendly with Charles Lindbergh and acted as his interpreter in German uniform when the Lone Eagle visited various Nazi factories and army posts. And he was a keen supporter of General Robert Wood, the head of America First. Rightly or wrongly, he was regarded by the German embassy in Washington as part of the pro-German military clique in the War Department. There is no question that he was a convinced isolationist who sincerely believed that the United States was not obliged to commit itself to war on behalf of Great Britain. Okay, before I go on with this, let me just point out a couple of things real quickly. Okay, Wiedemeyer graduated, as Dave mentioned, from the Kriegsakademie in 1938. He acted as an interpreter for Lindbergh while wearing a German uniform when Lindbergh was visiting Nazi factories. And he was a keen supporter of Robert Wood, the head of America First. And as we previously mentioned, America First, while on the surface an isolationist group, was in fact being funded by the Nazi Party, the German Nazis. This is important to remember. Okay, going on. Wiedemeyer was in his soul opposed to the purpose expressed in the very victory program to which he was assigned. Precisely why Roosevelt instructed him to draw up the plan, and then why Wiedemeyer chose to execute it, can only be regarded as a joint execution of executive duty, which overrode personal considerations.
In order to understand a little bit more about Wiedemeyer, and we're going to be looking at him extensively this evening, let's take a look at some of the people that he was associated with. We're going to look at Gerhard Rosbach at greater length here in just a second. A couple of remarks. General Friedrich von Boetticher was not only the German military attaché in Washington, but a key person involved with the basically German espionage and attempted subversion of the United States. So Boetticher is a key person for Wiedemeyer to be very close to. Now, it's also worth noting that he was a very close personal friend of General Ludwig Beck of the German General Staff. Now, Beck, although a bitter opponent of Adolf Hitler's, was a very, very dedicated Nazi. I think the one thing we might point out here for future purposes is the difference between anti-Hitler and anti-Nazi. There were many dedicated doctrinaire fascists and Nazis in Germany who hated Hitler for one reason or another. Some of them regarded him as low class. Many of them, including Ludwig Beck, differed with him very sharply on tactical considerations. Beck was one of the earliest defenders of the rights of German troops to join the Nazi Party. The first two open Nazis in the regular German army were in his unit, and he defended them very vehemently. Beck was regarded as the very embodiment of Prussian militarism, and as such, he differed with the sort of two-front war and conscript military philosophy that Hitler used, and he preferred a more limited war and using some of the traditional Bismarckian political alliances in order to gain victory. So Beck, who was a very close person, very close personal friend of Wiedemeyer's, was a very dedicated Nazi, although he did hate Hitler and eventually was executed by Hitler. It's worth noting, though, that he was a doctrinaire fascist and, as I say, regarded by many as the very embodiment of the spirit of Prussian militarism, which is something I think most Americans would not want to have too closely associated with anyone in our own general staff. Now, Gerhard Rossbach, from whom Wiedemeyer was renting his apartment, is a really, really important figure in the history of Nazism. Now, as we pointed out, the road to Hitler's ascension to power was paved by the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr, who simply murdered anyone who might have gotten in Hitler's way. Gerhard Rossbach was a key Freikorps leader, and we're going to take a look at some of his future endeavors in the Nazi Party in a minute. Now, not only was Rossbach a Freikorps leader, but Martin Bormann, perhaps the single most important person in the history of Nazism, if one looks at the entire course of that movement from 1919 up to the present day, was Martin Bormann, the number two man in the Reich officially, but in reality not only the most powerful, but also the most intelligent person in the Third Reich, and as we'll see in future programs, one of the dominant forces in modern history. Truly a genius, albeit an evil genius, but a very, very powerful man and a key figure in history. Of Gerhard Rossbach, his Freikorps, and Martin Bormann's beginning in that, we're going to take a look at information about it from a book called The Bormann Brotherhood. That was authored by William Stevenson, S-T-E-V-E-N-S-O-N. And that's to be distinguished from William Stevenson, spelled with a P-H, who was a British intelligence agent codenamed Intrepid. This William Stevenson was a Royal Navy pilot during the war and is now a broadcast journalist with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. His Bormann Brotherhood was published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich of New York, and it was copyrighted in 1973. Of Rossbach and Martin Bormann's start in the Rossbach Freikorps, he writes as follows. Speaking of Bormann, his love of money, his greed for power, were commented upon by Gerhard Rossbach in an interview many years later. Rossbach had led a Freikorps, a group of armed volunteers supported by the German army, which had been restricted in the number of regular soldiers it could keep on the books by the Versailles Treaty. Bormann became treasurer of the group after it underwent several changes of name to evade the law. The mission of the Freikorps was to weed out weaklings said to have caused German sufferings. The groups were also used to fight Bolshevik forces on the eastern frontier. But the young German Republican government also saw them as a threat to its own existence. They were declared illegal in 1920, but were more active than ever by 1923 when the French executed Leo Schlageter, a Freikorps soldier, for industrial sabotage. And so remember that Martin Bormann gets his start with the Rossbach Freikorps, and that Gerhard Rossbach rents his apartment to Albert Wiedemeyer while Wiedemeyer's in Germany.
Another brief look at Gerhard Rossbach and how the part that he played in some of these things, and the fact that he was rather a significant person, although his name is not very well known to us. This is a very short segment from a book called Der Führer, Hitler's Rise to Power, written by Konrad Heiden, H-E-I-D-E-N, translated by Ralph Mannheim, and published by Houghton Mifflin Company in 1944. This is one of those hard-to-find books Dave was alluding to earlier. Talking about Gerhard Rossbach, Konrad Heiden writes, Lieutenant Rossbach's troop, roaring, brawling, carousing, smashing windows, shedding blood, and nevertheless seeking the light of freedom, was equally proud to be, quote, different from the others. Heines, somebody he'd been talking about earlier, had belonged to it before joining Hitler. Then Rossbach and Heines had formed a center with Röhm, and that, of course, was Röhm, the head of the SA, the stormtroopers, Ernst Röhm. It led the SA while Hitler was under arrest. I'm sorry, it led the SA while Hitler was under arrest. So essentially what they're saying is that Rossbach and this other man, Heines, had formed a particular troop that led the stormtroopers while Hitler was under arrest. So Rossbach and this other man were essentially, for a while, substitute Führers of the movement before the Nazis came to elected power.
Now, one of the things that we've looked at here on this broadcast for a long time is, of course, the incorporation of many Nazis into the CIA and our military at the end of World War II. We'll be taking a look at that more later in the broadcast. Worth noting here that Gerhard Rossbach, in whose Freikorps unit we find the janitor of Martin Bormann, the political janitor of Martin Bormann, the fellow who led the stormtroopers while Hitler was in Landsberg prison, and the fellow who later rents his apartment to Albert Wiedemeyer after the war went to work for, among others, the CIA, returning again to the Bormann Brotherhood by William Stevenson. Rosbach, who was a Nazi intelligence agent in France and Turkey during World War II, was known to Western intelligence as an old man with a considerable and reliable memory for detail. Until his death at the age of 74 on September 1, 1967, he was consulted regularly by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and historians. So, another Nazi connected to the CIA.
Yeah, isn't it strange? How do these things happen? Okay, going back and talking about Friedrich von Baedeker, among others, and his connections to some of these folks, who, as we mentioned before, was one of Albert Wiedemeyer's primary contacts among the Nazis pre-World War II and up through and even right up until the beginning of hostilities in Europe in September 1939. Another segment from American Swastika by Haim. The numerous memoranda of Hans Thompson and Baedeker to Berlin at the time, remember Baedeker was the chief attaché in Washington, and Baedeker to Berlin at the time indicate that a series of contacts had been established in the general staff centering upon the War Department itself. This, of course, is the American general staff. Members of this group held meetings at the home of former American military attaché in Berlin, Colonel Truman Smith. Although pro-German and a sympathizer of America First, Smith had the ear of General Marshall. He also was closely connected to Rear Admiral Stanford C. Hooper, another isolationist, and needless to say, to Colonel Lindbergh. That's Charles Lindbergh. Yet another member of the group was Lieutenant Hubert L. Allensworth of the Army Air Corps, who it seems was privy, along with his superior, General H. H. Hap Arnold, to details of the program. This, of course, was the Victory Program, the Rainbow Five that was being put together. The chief contact of this group on Capitol Hill was Burton K. Wheeler of Montana. That's Senator Burton K. Wheeler. According to FBI files, Wheeler had access, through various leaks, to privileged documents. In those days of lax security, senators were able to get their hands on any number of classified documents and make use of them as they saw fit. Baedeker met Truman Smith, Wiedemeyer, that's our Albert Wiedemeyer, and Major Alfred J. Williams of the Marine Corps Reserve and the Scripps Howard newspaper chain on several occasions, using certain journalists as an outlet. Admiral Hooper even supplied Wheeler, with classified Navy documents stating that the Germans had, quote, no capacity for launching an air invasion against the United States, a fact which a high school knowledge of aviation would have established. Wheeler, in turn, handed over the information to George Sylvester Viereck, who, in turn, handed on to Baedeker.